Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Explicit Measures podcast with Tommy, Seth, and Mike. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Mike.
Got a number of really good intros today. Just a couple articles have been passed out recently. Looks like everyone's getting a little bit excited about all these new things coming out from Power BI Desktop. So we'll jump into those in our news section. But before we do that, we're going to talk today about templates. We at Power BI Tips are big fans of templates and working smarter, not harder. Trying to build a more efficient workflow is kind of the thing that we're all about, and kind of how we started the website. And a lot of the things that we do are just kind of trying to teach people there's a better way than clicking all the buttons. So we're going to get in deep dive with some templates. Data Meerkat has a great article. Steven is talking about Power BI templates and kind of talks to the different areas or the different parts of a Power BI template. There's a number of different formats now that you can go use and create and build things with. So how does that work, and how can you leverage these to make you look and work smarter and faster? All right. With that, let's go into some introductions or topics. Tommy, what's the news today? What do we got?
We got three very interesting topics. No necessarily breaking news, just three good nuggets of information. First one is by our good friend Eric Seth. Seth, do you want to say it? I'm terrible with Swedish names. Eric Svensson. Yes. The S and the V have always thrown me off. But he's phenomenal. I love his articles when they come out. He just came out with combining visual calculations and numeric parameters to create a dynamic moving average. This is hitting home for me because I've done this in DAX, and where basically you select, hey, show me a 3-month rolling average, a 6-month or 9-month, just by selecting a slicer on a line chart. I've done that in DAX. It's no fun to get that set up. It's a lot of lines. And we just talked about two visual calculations. So it's like, oh, maybe here's a good use case, because that may not be a measure that's going to be ever part of like that certification process, right? That sounds like more from an analytical thing. More often than not what someone's looking at the company's goal at.
So another interesting twist that he does on this one is he actually makes a parameter as well that allows you to adjust the amount of smoothing or the moving average that you want. So the length of the smooth, right? So what you'll do for smoothing typically is I'm going to look at the last three data points, and those last three data points is how many, like if you're doing months, I'm going to do a moving average over 3 months. Maybe I want it over 6 months. Maybe I want it over 12 months. So he actually does a really interesting addition to this. Not only is he using visual calculations in the visual, but he's also allowing you to adjust the amount of smoothing you want based on a slicer, which I think is actually, I really like that. I thought that was a very slick, neat example there as well, how he's incorporating the parameter in addition to letting it use the visual itself. So now, I was very confused on how did you get the moving average to change inside a visual calc where the visual calc was interacting with other data points? Because my understanding was a visual calc can only work on the data that's supplied to the visual. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was really interesting that it was allowing you to adjust that using on the moving average portion by generating a different series.
It's so simple this way too.
Well, this is why visual calcs kind of started to exist.
Yeah. It's a whole new world.
Yeah.
Like this is, I think, one of many where as the community really, really gets their head around and adopts visual calculations, to your point, Tommy, like this would be a very long, very complicated thing to build. And this is a step-by-step. You know, the fact that Eric went through and was like, hey, can I actually, like, what other things will interact with or work with visual calculations? And the net result is a big benefit to business users, right? Because it's not big, scary DAX that, oh my gosh, thanks for, you know, outlining how to build this all out in a DAX formula or series of them. And then you have the inevitable question, it doesn't work in my model, right? Where this sort of tutorial and step-by-step thing is where business users can leverage and get a not an immense amount of value. Like, this is a very complicated thing to do prior to visual calcs.
You know, it's funny too, because I'm thinking about all the scenarios that I've had back in the day where, like, hey, the report's great, but we'd really like to see X, Y, and Z. That's the really important. And that's the usual DAX that takes the longest time. It's that very specific use case that's apparently essential for them, that I've always been like, okay, we got to figure this out. I have the three measures. I have to clean it up again. Oh, look, two lines in visual calcs. Done. Weekend saved.
Bingo.
What else you got, Tommy?
Well, one thing I didn't put on our agenda, but Mike, they just announced Windows Surface 10. It has a Copilot button.
Windows 10?
Surface 10.
Windows the Surface 10.
I thought we were talking about Power BI on this show. I don't really. Let's skip that one. Let's go over to the actual docs. All right. Power BI. I don't care about Windows 10 with Copilot, Tommy.
Put it in the parking lot, Tommy.
Focus, Tommy. Focus.
A little technical, too. I mean,
no. All the things that we use. Moving on.
Number two is Power Query, or what I believe we're calling FXGPT. And this is from the Power of Business Intelligence. And all it is a custom function in Power Query to basically go through your columns, and you can add a prompt to it, and then it will auto-generate from there. So kind of cool. I can't imagine the tokens.
Yes, this is a bit wild in my opinion. So they're taking Power Query, writing a custom function that you'd send text into, which then uses it, bundles it, sends it to ChatGPT, and returns M. Is that what it's doing?
Yeah, exactly. You got to assume a user and what model you're going to use from ChatGPT.
And that's crazy. I think it goes
row by row, but I kind of have a few use cases. I had right now a column with, I think it's like 761 unique values. And I'm like, how could I AI group this? Because they're all very similar. Like, oh, this could work.
Interesting. And I don't really know. I like the idea that we can do flexible things like this.
Yeah.
In my mind, I go, though, is this really practical, usable? Like, it's a cool example. It's a neat little demo. Like, cool, this is interesting. But, man, I'm finding a lot of the ChatGPT stuff, or even just the AI things in general, it has to be, like, people have to do a lot of testing to get it to do what it wants. It doesn't quite amaze the way I think it will. But I think it's definitely getting better. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see where the depths of this Copilot stuff will allow you to go, and where the product team will take it, and how they can shape the prompting in a way that makes sense to the users. I think that's going to be the hardest part, is helping users be able to create the correct prompts to get out what they want.
Yeah.
What I'm finding across the Microsoft suite in general, every program has its own unique way of prompting. Like, you think about it, like, the way I would want to prompt in PowerPoint is different than what I would prompt in Excel, which is different than what I would prompt in VS Code, which is also different how I would prompt in Power BI, either building reports or building DAX or M, right? So you think about, like, the different context of what Copilot needs to do, and the teams have to develop a Copilot for that specific type of persona. It's challenging, because as a user of multiple of those products, you kind of have to learn what works in each tool.
Which is interesting, because essentially what you're saying is I need a Copilot to find the right prompt.
Copilot.
Well, but ultimately what that leads to is a library of prompts that I then have to search for the right prompt.
That's what I'm saying.
And then go execute against Copilot to get the right result.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of mind-bending a bit.
Just slightly.
And the value though, and we talked about this last Thursday in the podcast a little bit, just from the foundations of data, right? Like, all this stuff still needs to be organized, or at least put in a sensible way. Otherwise, you risk the output not being what you would expect it to be, right? So now we're saying, like, not only does the data in some way, shape, or form have to, you know, tie out to a potential answer, right? In order for it to be accurate, we're also saying, well, you have to ask in the right way still.
And you need to be,
and that's going to be different per product, you know. And, so we're introducing a different level of complexity here.
And you have to be really conscious when you're using the API of cost. I'm curious if with all the things that we've talked about, how much more expensive Dataflow's Gen 2 are compared to notebooks from processing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that has anything, like if there's any correlation here, but because you can easily spend more than you're willing in a ChatGPT if you're using a lot of APIs. You're like, hey, I'm just going to go over the next 15,000 rows with ChatGPT.
That's an interesting point, because when you're doing Copilot, Copilot will let you look at, I mean, Copilot charges based on the CU usage. There's a CU, you know, the number of words you send in is how much CU you're going to consume. I would imagine because, you know, ChatGPT or Copilot is running on graphics processor units, it's very expensive and it's costly for them to run that stuff. So what, I mean, in my mind, when you say that, Tommy, I think I want different things to fail when I run out of capacity units. Like I have an order of precedence that I may care about, right? For example, during the middle of the day, if I have a whole bunch of people hitting Copilot and my reports stop rendering, I want Copilot to fail first and then fail my reports. If I have, you know, data set refreshes working in the background and I have Copilot running and I have reports being rendered, I would want the back end systems to continue to load. And then I would want to make sure the reports are still in loading. And then I would want ChatGPT to run. So I'm not exactly sure how all this is going to pan out, but I'm also thinking here as well, like, again, as I was going through my class recently and thinking about the different Fabric SKUs that we have now, now that Fabric is kind of out and they have announced the retirement of the P SKUs, there's really no reason why you need any other SKU other than a Fabric SKU for premium. But with this, you can have a lot more catered experiences for different workloads that don't allow ChatGPT in them. Like, let me give you an example, right? Back-end loading, you're building a lakehouse and maybe you're loading your semantic models. Those may not need a full F64 all the time to run. So maybe you can put those workloads on a smaller F SKU that doesn't even have ChatGPT on it, so below 64. So therefore, you're never at risk of people asking questions of your data or using that and then hurting that part of your process. So you're literally isolating the features away from what you need, like mission critical stuff. And then when you're doing like front-facing reports, that's maybe an F64. And because now you're dividing, you can divide the workspaces into different capacities, now you can shift that load somewhere else.
You think by using different capacities that are not Copilot enabled, like lower, that it's going to remove the data from the purview of a potential F64 Copilot?
You have to attach, like when you use Copilot in desktop or anywhere, you have to attach it to a workspace that has F64 on it. So if you're in desktop and you try and use Copilot,
I get it. So, but you're isolated. You think your thought here is you're going to isolate data based on capacity.
I think you're going to isolate workloads based on capacity. I mean, before it wasn't that way. It was like, it was, you know, everything was a nail and I have a hammer and it's just all on premium, right? That was the original thinking. And maybe I have a division between dev and prod. Now I'm thinking, because now I have lake houses that may need to be their own lake house. I may have semantic models that need to refresh in their own workspace. So now I'm seeing the distribution of security and workspace. So now we're talking workloads. We're talking teams of people that need to be to segmented. I think there's more opportunity. Again, I'm saying you have to do this. I'm saying this is an opportunity for you to more comprehensively think about your environment. And I think also it provides you much more opportunity to automate, right? So in the morning, you turn on your F64 for backend loading, you let it run all your data sets, and then you turn it back down to an F4 during the day because you're not loading any more data. And then now you've saved yourself a bunch of money. All your semantic models have now can go back to the lake house and pull out what they want. There's no compute needed for direct lake because it's on the semantic model side. So then you're saving yourself a whole bunch of money there. So I feel like there's a workload to SKU relationship happening now or going to be able to happen.
So I'm confused. Are we talking about two different things, or I misunderstood what you were trying to communicate, because I heard you talking about manipulating capacities for cost.
Correct.
And but I thought we started in manipulating capacities to only allow Copilot access to certain data.
So the answer is yes to both. You can manipulate SKUs for cost, but you can also manipulate SKUs for features as well. Which is Copilot.
Testing this out, but because if I have a workspace that is in an F64 capacity, that is Copilot enabled,
yep,
I can connect to data from other workspaces, right? I can have shortcuts or...
Sure, but that's a shortcut's not using the capacity from a different workspace.
Understood.
Yeah.
So your presumption is that what'd you say?
Go ahead. I don't think it's a presumption. Oh. I think it's what happens, but okay.
Well, I would love to test it out. You're saying that you would think that the data in a shortcut from a non-F64 capacity would not be available to Copilot.
It doesn't matter if it's from Copilot. It's where the compute's being used from. It's the data's still available. Blob storage is just flat storage. There's no cost for you to have storage in a different workspace.
I thought your point to Copilot was to manipulate what data it had access to.
No, not at all. Okay. I'm not talking anything about data access. I'm talking more about cost and management of cost pieces, because where the workspace the Copilot lives in, that's the one that's going to get charged for the CUs of the Copilot.
But okay, so let's take my idea.
Okay.
which I don't know if it resonates in anywhere, but like that would be interesting, right? Where you're plain scaling, but I still want to use Copilot, but I'm going to run typically on a much lower SKU, but still have access to all the data by shortcutting from a workspace that's not under 64.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Rather than everyone.
Now, that's the thing is that data available?
Mm-hmm. It is. I'm pretty sure. I'm almost 100% certain. If it's in, and again, the thing I don't know is, are they hard blocking? Like, even imagine this. I haven't tested this one. This is one I actually physically need to test. Turn on a workspace, put it in Fabric, run some stuff, hydrate the data into the lake, then put it back on a pro license. So the lake, the one lake, has the ability to see the data in the workspace, but there is no Fabric capacity attached to the workspace.
Let me ask this
question. So that's one thing I don't know will work. I don't know if they've actually blocked that path at this point. I have to test that one.
What would you prefer? Would you prefer the hijinks that you're talking about, where we're manually manipulating capacities and using different things to, well, I don't know what you would be turning it up and down outside of manually. Like, is there some sort of automation that you think is available? Because
this is what
we're in an ecosystem as opposed to independent services.
Correct. So right now, so this is what I think. Let me say it this way. I just ran my class and I brought up this exact topic and they loved the idea. And they're like, you build it, Michael, we'll pay for it. Like multiple large customers were asking for this exact feature, because today there is no easy automation button of just saying, like, so think about Databricks and how it auto scales up and down. You basically said, here's my minimum workload, here's my maximum workload. The tools that we're given today are very close for us to be able to actually scale up and down and have this all automatic. What Microsoft will, either Microsoft's going to have to build this or someone's going to build this, yours truly, will build it. And therefore, from that, it'll actually force Microsoft's hand to start thinking about auto scaling the F-SKUs. So what should be happening here is you should turn on an F-SKU. It should start at an F2, no matter what. It should always start in F2. And what you should do is you should start throwing workloads at it. I'm going to load this data set. I'm going to load these things. Microsoft should be able to approximate what that data set load will look like and say, uh-oh, we've already maxed out the F2, or let it run for just a hot second and it maxes out the F2. Look, I'm hitting at my threshold at 100. And then when it says, okay, I'm going to bump up, this looks like a workload that I need to bump up to an F8. So then it would then scale up to the F8, which would exactly what Databricks does, scale up to the level it needs, run the job, and then within 15 minutes, it scales itself back down to the smaller amount. Like, that level of automation should be built into the product right now.
Yeah, but at the same time here, I provided very similar feedback to certain individuals. but But I would say no. Your description of even how Databricks works is not as altruistic as you consume. There are a ton of workloads or things you can kick off where it just goes, hey, I'm going to max out everything. I'm going to max out your whatever you selected, and I'm going to go full bore, and then it's going to fail, and I'm still going to run for a couple hours. You know, so there are inefficiencies even in the low, like min and max cluster usage.
Yeah, but it does eventually ramp down, turn off.
However, I agree from the standpoint that a little bit better of the burst up, burst down, scale up, scale down type of activity would be extremely worthwhile. Where I think any of these companies win is where they build confidence with consumers that they're going to manage that for you, and they're looking at cost optimization for you. Mm-hmm. Because as a heavy consumer of mm-hmm. Microsoft services and others and third party, it is the largest pain in the rear for any organization to get stability or understanding around costs. Mm-hmm. And if you stabilize the foundational data, and realistically, if we look in the long, like in the spectrum, I think out 5, 10, 15, 20 years, right? Like where we're at now is this is the foundational data era, right? Like we have tons of data. We've figured out how to store it cheaply, yep. and compute of those workloads should be extremely well known to all of these companies. You build trust in optimizing that cost, and that frees up money to go spend it on all your AI stuff.
100%.
Then you plug that in, and that's where all my CPU goes. And I'm like, yep, I'm all in, because it does, like, now the data processing and storage, like the, hey, I just need to form my data so I can leverage it kind of thing, is like, I think we're there. I think we're right in that realm where it's like, there's an acceleration point here, and whoever makes the ease of use of storage and CPU of just the data things, right? Because mm-hmm. I think that, like, we're already kind of moving past the conversation of like the foundations, which is always interesting for us as data engineers and BI developers, because we know how much work it takes to like get things through these processes. But we also know that you could screw up in this environment and cost your organization $1,000 in a day instantly. Yep. Easily. So are there guardrails on like the capacity itself in Fabric not allowing you to do that where you could in other tools? Yeah. But at the same time, you could probably also be saving a ton of money, especially as you're proliferating Fabric throughout an organization that would need to be streamlined.
And Mike, that's actually the direction I thought you were going to go. That's actually one of the, I think, the approaches in documentation is that you have dedicated capacities for Copilot because it can be a significant load on a capacity. And if you just do everything Copilot in every workspace, if that's part of your, we know semantic models can take up an entire premium capacity. We've seen that before. So now you're combining Copilot. So that's from a much simplified approach. One of the things Microsoft said, and I think that makes sense, is there's dedicated workspaces that are going to be meant for Copilot for the right people, because if everyone's prompting all the time, and I hope your sales team has some things in the pipeline.
Well, and
they're prompting
again,
the right things.
The name of the game here is make it easy. Really is what this is, right? So all these services are Azure, more Azure-based services. What I see Fabric doing is Fabric is going to absorb more and more Azure-based services. And so they're going to continue bringing those features to Power BI. And again, the easy button here is we need to be able to capture cost for network traffic, for CUs, all the things. And so everything's becoming this capacity unit based measurement, which I think is good. I think it's already, it's a good place to go. All right, Tom, do you want to skip the last announcement here and just go right to the main topic? Mm-hmm. All right, so in an effort of having a long conversation around these news articles today, which has been great, also very great for talking about topic things, good things to think about and consider. Moving forward then, let's talk about our main topic today. Today is talking about Power BI templates. And again, as we've said, we're big fans of templates. We think this is super huge. It helps out organizations a ton and adds a massive amount of value to your workflows. So Stephen gives us a great article around this one. The link will be in the description from Data Meerkat, and it'll be Power BI templates is the main article here.
So for the rest of the world, outside of Mike's close personal friend, Stephen, this is Stepan Rischel, I think, who's from the Czech Republic. So I'm going to run that past my wife and she'll yell at me later for me like that. I am so disappointed in you that you still didn't get it right. But hopefully that's a little closer.
Yeah, true. True. So give us a quick overview, Tommy. What's the general gist of this article here?
So you may be aware already of a Power BI template. Oh, yeah, there's the PBIT. But you may not know there's now actually four other ways you can technically create a template. In the service, in your developer tools, which you may have never either heard about or have no idea how to use. And obviously, we love the Power BI templates, the theme generator, really talking about report-based themes. Stephen. Stephen starts with the visual templates, the report-based templates. Some people also use data templates, which is actually based filtering or configuring the model, what data is coming in. And that's what we're all aware of. That's what we probably all know. However, Microsoft has actually quietly released in over the last couple of years, and especially with Fabric, a lot of additional ways to create a theme that all serve a very different purpose. For example,
I wouldn't say quietly. I think I would say with a lot less fanfare than like visual calcs, right? They've released them, but the community is like, yeah, I see the point, but I don't want to write JSON. Like they're released, but the community doesn't really maybe have the tooling they need to support it yet.
I think if I polled 100 Power BI professionals, I think 10 of them would know about putting template on a new report in the service at the suffix, knowing that tool. So let me kind of explain. So you can actually go into the semantic model in the Power BI service. And when it says, hey, create a new report off the semantic model, if you add the suffix parentheses template and parentheses, it actually creates a template file that when someone is going to create a new report off that model, uses the template. So that's one way it lives in the service only. New with developer tools, well, we also have the PBIDS file. And we also have Power Query Gen 2 templates, the model.json. And so very developer tools as well. So our options have, like you said, without a lot of fanfare, expanded.
Yeah, I don't even know, honestly, if there's even a blog out that lets you see the model starting from template experience. I think that was out there for a bit. We might actually have to blog that one because I don't know. I can't put my fingers on any articles that actually describe that exact feature. And honestly, I don't know if they've deprecated it or they've even kept it around. I'm not even sure if that still exists.
Which is this one that we're talking about, like in the service?
So in the service, if you publish a report connected to a model and you change the name of the report to actually contain like parentheses, template parentheses, in the name, it knows that is the template file that they want you to use when you create a start from existing or start from new report in the service. So the idea would be is you could have like a page with some theming stuff in it. So that way, when you create on top of that data set, it now automatically has a template to start from. So I think that's the feature.
That one seems like that's an interesting finder, like the way you figured that out kind of thing, as opposed to a standard Microsoft. Like, to me, it would just be easy. Like, hey, do you want to create the explore the model, create a template if they wanted you to do that. Like, I loved it. I love the idea. I just haven't seen it anywhere else but this blog, which is interesting. So I'll like noted. We'll give it a crack.
We ripped
through a ton of the different types of templates. For all users that may not be familiar with them, should we walk through like what are the specific things you can do in each template?
I'll let you drive for the sake of time. I think you can.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
Templates start. So he starts kind of outlining the different kinds of templates, right? There's things at the visual level. There's things at the theme level. There's things at a report level. So building like kind of the templates for working with data models. You have data templates, like the .bim file. Like that's,
Yeah. And I guess what are the things we can do with them, right?
Yeah. Then you have the PBIDS file. So a Power BI data source file, which allows you to create a common connection to like a SQL server, an Oracle database. Like you can then share the connection to other people. Then he also talks about the model.json file. So the model.json file describes a data flow and how the data flow stores its information. So you can actually manipulate a data flow using the model.json file and add your own data. Now there's a Power Query template file, PQT file. So that also now exists. And I think those are all the templates that I'm aware of that he's talked about in the file. Did he actually speak on the PBIP file? I don't think I saw that in there directly called out.
He did.
Okay. So the PBIP format, and also, by the way, just recently at SQL Bits, there's now a PBI report improvement as well. So I believe Rui Romano and Mohammed, I believe, just did a demo over at SQL Bits, and there were some Twitter pictures that were recently sent out that were describing this new feature around, hey, there's now a new format for the report side. The report side is now a breaking format, but this new format now includes all JSON elements for all the report side of things. So it's basically making it easier for the report to be consumed and used or built on top of. So that was kind of interesting as well. So those are all the surface area. So what can you do with all these things? A lot of this is like prep work in front of. So some of this is just sharing data. Like the PBIDS is just sharing a common connection string. But a lot of the other ones, like visual templates, PBIP formatted files, the BIM definition of different files, all these other templates are kind of intended to store a pre-built solution and then kind of help you get started from there. So you basically can cut out a lot of initial busy work or create a uniform experience when you're building stuff.
Yeah. And we really don't talk about this enough, right? Like templates are in many ways an opportunity for the hardcore dev teams to pre-build easy use solutions or shortcuts for the maybe less than technical users. So like that maybe somebody who understands data or modeling, but messing around with all the connections or obviously themes. And we could talk about that ad nauseum, but we'll hold off on that.
We like that one for sure.
Yeah, we do, you know, from the visual layer and reporting side, but why don't we talk about it more?
I think not really easy there to support it yet.
Agreed, but at the same time, like even in Stepan's article, it is developer focused. Like these are the back end pieces that are all there for us to build these artifacts or easy buttons for business to engage. And it just strikes me as we're ripping through each one of these that we're not promoting them as part of a, you know, program or adoption, or why aren't they in the adoption, right? Like, hey, a great strategy for as you're introducing this thing to the wide audience of wherever is templates and, or, you know, the PBIDS where you're, you know, pre-providing connections that just auto work or whatever the case.
Correct. Yes.
My theory of why we don't promote or really talk about it is I think there needs to be a lot more careful planning. We have six different options with six different file types that are going to be stored more or less in six different locations. And it's not necessarily Windows Explorer. It's not, they're all over the place. So if users start going pretty liberal in terms of, hey, we're going to create some service ones. Oh, we got some developer ones. We got the report ones. Well, how can you actually centralize and manage that? I think that makes it overly complicated. I think there needs to be more careful planning on what are we going to deploy and what are we going to allow. I think from the developer point of view, there's some documentation out there, but I mean, this is one of the few articles that I've actually seen where it actually goes through not just what a template is from the developer point of view, but here's some approaches that you can take. We know what to do with a PBIT. It's pretty simple. Use it for your theme file or use it for the connect straight data stored in SharePoint so everyone has a centralized location. That makes it simple.
Well, I mean, there's also the one use case that I've used extensively, which is the allowing a setup of a Power BI file to include parameters that somebody's got to log in right away, which you can like make the easy buttons as far as connections are concerned, or at least ease that pain a little bit. But the end user who's using it is automatically prompted to input certain fields without having to know that they have to go into Power Query, update a data connection, et cetera, yeah. Et cetera, et cetera. So that in itself is the one use case that I think is probably the most relevant that you're blowing past that I just want to point out, but that is like you prompted right off the bat, fill in this information, and then it just goes and does its thing. And that's my point, I guess. So I feel like you're trying to argue with me for no reason, but continue.
Let me give one more perspective before we move on to keep arguing about that point, because I think you got some good points there on both sides. I also think Microsoft has not done it justice on how they incorporate the use of templates into the rest of the product, right? So
fair.
All these things exist, and Microsoft themselves uses these templates for things. And I think the really reason why Microsoft has developed any sort of templating on anything is self-serving. Mm. You know, they want a PBIDS file so that way when they had Purview show up, Purview could connect to any data source that's being generated from Power BI. So they could read a source and say, hey, look, we have a shortcut that we can use in Power BI Desktop to automatically connect you to this linked server or this SQL database. Right? So they wanted that easy connection string. So they built it for themselves because they needed it in other tooling. That's why it was built. They just happened to get it out. They document it and say, here's our standard. You're more than welcome to use it if you want. But no one else has, and this isn't a good example, is no one else has like a full Purview type service that they can build that actually start curating source connection files. Now, you'll also notice too, Databricks has an instant connector that talks directly to so you go to their SQL endpoint, the SQL endpoint has a connection string. Inside that connection string is all the information you need for Databricks to connect to Power BI. And you can go ask for data from the SQL endpoint. Databricks now has a single button press that says, go visualize your data in the Power BI tool. That's making a PBIDS file that is then passed over to Power BI that you then immediately click on it, you log in and you're in. So again, big systems, big companies or tooling pieces are now able to leverage that thing. That's why Microsoft produces these things. I think what's missing here is more of a catered story for like the development team, the leader of that development team, the governance and making it a unified experience. That doesn't seem like it's there yet. There's no concept of like a global theme that sits across your entire tenant.
That's what I'm suggesting. Like, why? You know, it's interesting because because we're talking about this and all just laying out all of these, like, you know, shortcut, these easy things that are buckets of work that we could implement it. I'm calling out. It's interesting that it's not part of the conversation more.
Yes. Well, okay. Let's look at Microsoft. Hey, we just turned
I'm not suggesting that Microsoft should have laid all of this out for us because we know they don't do that. Say, here's our technology. Hey guys, go have fun. And we have fun. I guess maybe let me repoint my question. No, I asked it correctly. Why haven't we as a community talked about templates more or made them more part of our adoption or our implementation?
Again,
is it because they're still pieces and they're disjointed to some degree, Tommy? I get it. Like, yes, they're all over the place, but at the same time, where can you go build a report? Or how many different ways can you slice the same thing in the Power BI ecosystem? That's not confusing for end users.
No, but that's different because there's a dependency where I need to find my template files for my team. So there's the origin. that you want to keep centralized. Let me ask you a question. When would you, let's take the simple two different ways to create a Power BI template. When would you encourage the create a new report in the service using that parentheses option?
That seems like a hack. I wouldn't. But okay. if it was a standard way for us to create templates for people, and well, I had a service right. template base.
Yes.
You're saying when and where would I do that?
Yeah, exactly. When would that be a better feature than using a PBIT or using the local Power BI file?
But this is my point, though. My point is, Tommy, like, this is what I was trying to say earlier, and you guys kept talking on my point here. You don't use them in the service because there's not a good solution to lock people out of not starting with the template, like, or there's not a good way of using the template as a integrated part of the solution. So like Microsoft's excited about all these other things they're building. They're not worried about templating solutions and how much easier it makes our life. Like in my perfect vision of this would be go to the workspace at the workspace level, upload 6 templates that you're allowed to pick from. Here we go. Template. Any data set, any semantic model, literally make it a centralized thing that is, here are workspace level assets that are going to be used across the entire Power BI ecosystem. And again, Microsoft, if you're listening, hopefully someone at the team over there is listening to the podcast. Here's your next $750,000 idea here's the next $250,000 idea that's going to take a lot of time to develop, but I'm going to give it anyways. But thinking through that and going, okay, what if I had, not only building workspace assets for your templates or Power BI PBIP files or PBIT files, upload them, get them started. That way everywhere in that workspace experience, I can, and then let the admin of the workspace control everyone must start from a template, or you have the ability to create something without a template, a blank sheet. And then also add the ability for you to add a theme file that can be forced to be on all reports or not, and have that happen at the workspace level.
But you could add that in the template.
But what happens when you have someone create a brand new blank file with no template attached?
So, yes and no. But it's like, because we've talked about, I love all of your ideas and I agree 100% with them. But it's because it's the way you create standardization. Yes. Even if you have a Power BI template that is like, here's the theme, here's what this looks like, here's, and then raw, like, here's the connection to the model. Everyone starts here if you want to share this out widely within an organization.
Sure.
Because we're going to put some things in here that everybody knows that this is a finance report. Everybody knows right. this is a commercial mm-hmm. report. You want to go build your own stuff? Fine, but you're not sharing it with everybody in the organization because we have standards. We have a process. Like, we don't want the Wild West of everybody having to figure out how you built a report. And I think that's exactly where you would fit this in. Is it everywhere in the ecosystem of Power BI? No, but it is in the realm of like where I'm going to start sharing things throughout. And you could really streamline and make, I think, much better solutions in this ecosystem with templates versus just what it is right now, which is everybody just building their own thing. Unless you know or are running your own templates behind the scenes off Power BI desktop files, because most people don't even work with the PBIP file format or PBIT format, and they're like, oh, scary, that's not the PBIX. We're like, well, in reality, you save that into that. There's an easy path to that ecosystem, and it's done for you.
Yes. And I think this is restricted because of that extra little bit of friction. It's restricted companies from actually developing. I'm going to toot our own horn here for a bit. We are the only company in the world who's building PBIPs. Like, we're the only company in the world who's building wireframes, PBIPs, template files, literally talking about, let's build a standard that needs to happen for your company or your team. Start here. And we're provided with AI-based tools inside the template building experience. Like, we're generating visuals on the page for you. I can create an entire report, look, feel, style within 5 or 10 minutes, as opposed to having to go into the service or starting to build one from scratch that takes hours to build. I mean, we're shaving off
for those listeners. For those listeners who don't know what like Power BI.tips theme generators, what you're referring to.
That's what I'm referring to. Yes, correct. Yeah. Sorry, I assumed everyone knew already.
Hey, I can't assume anything. But yeah, I mean, so But there's power there. There's obviously, right? We take a file, we let you do a ton of stuff, and then you have a starter that instantly turns into a report for you.
Correct.
Well, and yeah, I mean, we're huge time savers. Go check it out for sure. But that's what you can do. Like, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because yes, we don't like toot our own horn a lot on this podcast, which is probably good thing, because we probably wouldn't.
Let's go right, stinky here a little bit.
No, we wouldn't have an audience, I don't think. Like, hey, go check out our stuff all the time. But what I'm arguing for is exactly what we've done. We've leveraged a lot of these little bits and pieces. Granted, we've created an experience for users that shaves off at least half. If you're gonna spend a lot of time building a report, we're shaving off at least half of that time, right? Because it's all look and feel, set your properties once, like reuse. It's the reusable thing you can use everywhere. And then we create the PBIP file for you, right? Like, that's what I think I'm saying is like, hey, you know what? Why aren't we talking about the formats of these things, or what else could be extended by individuals in their own deployments of Power BI, leveraging templates more? So start with us, get that in there, and then, you know, like, have a standard process, right? Like, we're going to create a workspace. This is a workspace that's, you know, going to be used and shared out throughout the company. Our standards are, you're using these template files. This is where you start. Then we've driven a lot of all of the other stuff we've talked about into the fabric of how people build their net new processes. And it's all driven from standards. And I think that's what's cool about templates, and where my mind is going is these are ways we can build standards when we're making deployments. Correct. And I'm gonna reevaluate, like, where can I talk about this more, or leverage templates better than, I mean, ultimately the great starting point that you get coming out of theme generator.
Well, I think that's a big part, especially with the developer side, that hopefully there's a solution built on change management, right? So the theme generator, or having the PBIT, or those standard basic solutions. Well, I've created, great, we have our template everyone's using. Well, let's say we're making updates to that. Mm-hmm. Things are out of sync. People are out of sync. And there's no easy way to update your theme unless you're doing it individually. To me, that's another kind of roadblock, especially for teams, where I may be adding new pages to the theme file. It may not happen all the time, but you will find where you have a wide range of variance between different reports over time.
But you're speaking to things here, Tommy, that are very interesting. So let's just take, like, there's a macro and there's a micro version of what this is talking about, right? So the very focused, I don't know which one's right, the micro version, right? Focusing on the very detail pieces is, I have a report. A report gets a theme file. Done. Like, okay, so now when you scale up and look at the organization, I have hundreds, thousands of reports across hundreds, if not thousands, of workspaces. That stuff is amazing. And then you step back and say, how do I understand all the themed elements across all of my company? And does any of my quote unquote standards, and again, this is where I would also push for, you know, when you're talking about things that are certified versus not certified,
yeah,
I think you care more about the certified things having that similar look and feel. You're willing to bend more on the self-service side of things when it's not certified. So let's just take that window, right? You have a huge organization. I have a lot of things going on. And then I'm looking at only the certified artifacts that I care about. So just focusing on the certified portion, how do I configure, or how do I update, or how do I modify settings across all those reports? And I think there is capability now with PBIP format. There is capability now with Git that you can use for those kind of things. However, again, to your point, Tommy and Seth earlier, was there's no tooling to support this. There's no tooling to support the quick ingestion of all those different theme files, comparing them and making a common change across all of them.
Yeah.
You have the capability with Git to make the changes. You have the capability to, like, modify very small pieces of a file. But if you think about the bigger challenge for me in my mind right now is, look, we have these great things called deployment pipelines. Yeah. If I change a single measure definition in the dev environment, I don't get to deploy the measure definition across the environments. Yeah. I'm deploying the entire semantic model across all pieces. So I think what the community doesn't even know they need yet is they need finer grain controls around identifying what is the change and pushing only the change piece, and then not in, and then ensuring that things don't break long term. And I think this is where the challenge comes from, because Microsoft has to support small changes on lots of things, and today they don't. It's on all or nothing. They're not holding to.
It makes sense from like a pre-build standpoint that you can start these places, but the change management parts, would need to get much cleaner if you're going to do wider adoption.
Correct, but that is a dev way of thinking, mm-hmm. and you have to imagine like 80-90% of the Power BI community is not dev thinkers. They're thinking like the business side, and it's self-service, and it's I make my change on my one file that's easy enough for me to understand. I'm not trying to go in to pick and choose, and it's value added, but is it easy for users to comprehend what changes are being made and how to push those incremental changes across the things? That's not built yet.
Yeah.
So really, really cool thoughts there. One thing I think, Seth, that you're pretty interested around here is there's this new thing that came out in Dataflow's Gen 2, another template, the Power Query template files.
I've always been a fan of when doing trainings or teaching people how to do things, like, hey, here, I go quickly from here's the user interface. Look at all these steps.
Yeah.
And by the way, check out this advanced button right here. That like, bam, they go, oh my gosh, that's code. Yes. Right. And then it's like, copy this, paste it into your other report. Right. Yeah. And then like change the data. So bam. And it's like, bam, all there. And they're like, so the reusability, right. Of M code or, the sometimes extremely challenging transformations of data, mm-hmm. Is the value there, right? And I think what Stepan calls out in here is that there's a Power Query template that allows users to easily leverage that M code, and then points to a Chris Webb article where it's easier more now than ever to reuse that transformation code in between data flows or from Excel even to take it out of there and use it in a data flow, et cetera. And I think the call out here is just it's a time well spent, whoever developed the template for that, because those are, once again, huge time savers of saying, I did all this over here, but like, can I just move this basically this giant pipeline of transformation data into a different flow, and you absolutely can do that now.
But again, and this is the last thing I'll say, there's still that same roadblock piece right now. The only way that you can utilize templates is upload from your local computer. We're still lacking, I think, in all these solutions, and to kind of do that wrap around everything. That's
so negative.
I'm giving you.
I'm saying that because you guys point that at me. I'm so pessimistic. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you asked the original question. Why don't we think that we've really promoted this? I'm giving you an answer. At least my answer.
Well, okay. So, yes, I agree with your point, Tommy. There is no, something that's missing here is there is no central store integrated with what this is, right? To your point, Seth, and to your point, Tommy, it'd be really nice if the Power Query template files had the ability of saying, I'm just going to have an artifacts folder inside my workspace. It's literally a folder where I could say, upload my theme file, upload my templates, upload my whatever I want. It goes into the workspace. And then, hey, let's just say, for example, I do want to muck around with Power Query templates. What if I could just export them out of the data flow and just put it in my workspace folder and then come back and go get it? I don't have to, nothing comes down to my desktop. It all stays in the service. One, that would be genius. So there's another good Microsoft idea for you. We're fixing your tool as we speak right now, Microsoft.
enhancing
the tool. But to your point, though, this is also, and I'll point out my comment earlier, this is also a very self-serving feature of Microsoft to build Power Query template files. Because what is this for? The reason this is there is to help people migrate from other things into Power Query template pieces. So It's a migration effort that Microsoft is producing that you can then lift your old Power Queries out of the old service. Now, again, I don't think it's there yet. I don't think Power Query Gen 1 has this in data flows yet. But I would imagine this is not too far off in the future where they could just say, oh, look, here's a data flow Gen 1, export this PQT file, go over to Gen 2 and upload it. So I honestly think it's a very self-serving feature here, again, to get people to migrate to Fabric to make it easy for Microsoft to store this information. And maybe they internally will say, upgrade this data flow Gen 1 to data flow Gen 2. And what they're doing internally is creating the PQT file, creating the new data flow, and then uploading it there. So, you know, that could be all experience pieces that Microsoft may be developing behind the scenes. I don't know. But it would seem to me that this is what they want you to do, is just have an easy upgrade path from a Gen 1. This is why this exists. So anyways, I will say, when doing training classes, now having the ability to load things using a Power Query template file is much easier. So that, to me, feels like a really good experience. And so here, we're going to connect to this Northwind data services. I'm going to give you all the Power Query steps, load this file, boom, we're